Welcome to Series 2 of Nightmares of a Doctor. This series explores the extremes of human existence. Some of the themes in these stories will be challenging, and listener discretion is advised. If you are suffering from a mental health condition and find yourself in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything. This is the second part of the first episode of Series 2. If you've got here without having heard Part 1, I suggest you go back so that you can best understand the story I will tell. At the end of Part 1, Detective Superintendent Stuart Clifton was exploring his suspicions following a series of unexplained collapses on the pediatric unit of Grantham Hospital. But he found himself alone, with little evidence supporting his concerns, and a police force that was actively discouraging him from pursuing them. What Detective Clifton knew is that if the experts were wrong, children would die. The recent spike in child deaths at Grantham Hospital had caused a ripple of discontent, which reverberated up to the hospital management. But the findings of the recent independent medical review was all the reassurance that they needed to downplay their concerns, however troubling they might be. Despite the hesitation from hospital management, Ward 4 pediatric consultant Dr. Porter felt increasingly compelled to initiate an internal hospital inquiry. One of the early suggestions was that an airborne virus could potentially be responsible. The theory was investigated, but no virus was found. They then looked to re-review the blood results of the affected children, and it was there that Dr. Porter would finally make a breakthrough. The blood of deceased baby Claire was retested for abnormalities, and this revealed a high level of potassium in her blood. These findings were swiftly reported to the police, and an exhumation of Claire's body was subsequently arranged. An examination followed, showing traces of lignocaine throughout Claire's system. Lignocaine is a powerful drug, which can be used to manipulate the rhythms of the heart. It can be used to treat abnormal rhythms, but in the incorrect doses, it can potentially stop the heart altogether. But Dr. Porter's internal hospital inquiry did not end there. It also revealed multiple cases of missing nursing logs, one of which corresponded to the time that Paul Crampton had been admitted. Detective Superintendent Stuart Clifton now had more than enough to pursue his doubts of the so-called expert opinion. He threw the full weight of his team behind the case, and the resulting investigation looked closely through each of the most suspicious collapses occurring on Ward 4. For each of the affected children, the corresponding blood results showed inordinately high levels of insulin in most. Insulin is a drug most commonly used by people with diabetes to help control their blood sugar levels, also known as blood glucose. If the blood glucose levels gets too high, insulin may be administered to help bring glucose back down to normal levels. The challenge of diabetes is the level of control needed. When blood glucose gets too high, it can be toxic to the body. If blood glucose is too low, patients may experience the sensation of hunger, the body will start to tremble, and if not corrected quickly, the patient will deteriorate with confusion or even coma. Reduced blood flow to the heart will soon follow, and once the cardiovascular system has been affected, death may be imminent. Detective Clifton was building his case. He called in the country's leading expert on insulin poisoning, Professor Vincent Marks, a forensic scientist. He was able to test Paul Crampton's blood much more thoroughly than the standard laboratories. Professor Marks would later refer to these results as dynamite. He later said of those results, Paul had 47,000 milliliters of insulin in his blood. A normal reading for a child of his age is between 10 and 15. We were able to show that Paul had an astronomically high level of insulin in his blood. But that was not all that Professor Marks was to find. It was after Paul Crampton's second episode of collapse that Dr. Porter had suspected that Paul's high levels of insulin may be explained by a rare abnormality of the pancreas, known as nasidioblastosis. This is a condition that is characterized by extremely high levels of both insulin and a chemical known as peptide C. It offered a possible natural explanation for Professor Marks's findings. For various logistical reasons, Paul's original blood results had been delayed at a laboratory in Cardiff and were only made available on the 4th of April 1991. Not only did this show the extraordinarily high levels of insulin that Professor Marks had also seen, but it also showed that the levels of peptide C were so minutely small that they could not even be detected. The reasons for Paul's insulin levels could no longer be explained by any natural biological process. This latest result proved beyond doubt that the fatal levels of insulin in Paul's blood could only be attributed to the unnatural administration of pharmaceutical insulin delivered as an injection directly into Paul's blood. With this latest revelation, Professor Marks immediately phoned Detective Clifton. He told him, "You have got a cast iron case. Somebody was giving Paul insulin in big doses that he didn't need." With the spotlight of suspicion now fixed firmly upon insulin, each of the patient's drug records were carefully scrutinized. A check of the drug records subsequently showed that the key to the insulin refrigerator had been reported missing by one of the ward nurses, a 22-year-old called Beverly Allett. As well as all of the patient records being checked, parents of the victims were individually interviewed, and a security camera was installed onto the ward. Detective Clifton had identified at least 25 potentially suspicious episodes involving 13 patients, four of whom had died. He cross-referenced this with the staff rota records. It was there that Detective Clifton found a common factor: the presence of nurse Beverly Allett. Further examinations of the presence of ward staff compared to each suspicious episode showed the extent of the correlation between the times when Allett was on duty and the times of the collapses. In fact, a mathematical analysis was able to calculate that the statistical chance of this being attributed to unfortunate coincidence was less than 1 in 10 million. Police raided Nurse Allett's home and found a syringe, a hospital pillowcase, and a document detailing who on the ward is assigned to which child and when. This document was compared to a similar book held by the assigned ward sister. This showed that all the pages that covered the times of the Ward 4 collapses had been removed from the record. Detective Clifton knew that 22-year-old Beverly Allett had never been in trouble with the police and had no prior criminal history. He thought that given her background, if questioned by the police, she might be willing to confess. He could not have been more wrong. In fact, considering the growing public interest, Allett's behaviour was quite unexpected. When Allett was taken for questioning, Detective Neil Jones described her as quite calm, quite confident for someone who's just been arrested for murder. Detective Michelle Billingsley rode with Allett in the back of the police van when she was arrested. She describes her as being really laid back and chatty. The press were taking photos and she looked as if she were enjoying it. At this stage, the police confidently knew that at least one child, Paul Crampton, had been poisoned with insulin. While they suspected Allett as being responsible, they lacked the forensic evidence linking her with the crime. The pressure was on to get Allett to talk. During the police interview, it was suggested to Alet that everything pointed towards her. She responded by saying, "What can I do to say I didn't? I told you I didn't do it, and I wouldn't do it to anybody. I'm not bloody lying, I wouldn't do it." The police tried to pin Alet down on her exact movements in relation to Paul Crampton, but Alet was resolute. She said, "No matter what you say, I'm sticking to my story. I did not do it." With no decisive evidence, Alet's interviewers knew they could not hold her for long. They described her as being confident. She replied straight away. There was no hesitation. With no confession and insufficient evidence, Alet was released on bail. Detective Clifton found himself in the unfortunate position of having to release his prime suspect and needing to convince the hospital not to let her back on the ward. Fortunately, the hospital management did not need persuading, and Alet was put on extended leave. Detective Clifton was running out of options, and his case was now being threatened, but he was still far from giving it up. He looked at the ways Alet had behaved around her patients, and was somewhat surprised at the level of rapport she had developed with both her patients as well as their parents. She was widely adored. It was clear that Alet possessed the ability to be charismatic and well-liked. In the case of the Phillips twins, after Becky had died, Alet continued to be involved in the care of Becky's twin, Katie, who survived but was left with lasting brain damage. Katie's mother was so grateful for Alet's perceived efforts that she asked her to be her surviving daughter's godmother. Later on, when the evidence began to mount up against Alet, the father of another victim was so convinced of her innocence that he actually hired a private detective in defense of Alet. But her charm was not restricted only to her patients and their relatives. Staff on Ward 4 was susceptible too. During a particularly chaotic week, when children were collapsing at an alarming rate, one nurse in charge was quoted as saying of her, "Poor Beverly Alet has been there on every occasion. She has been a rock." The ward consultant, Dr. Nana Kayara, said of Alet, "We had a small unit with a small team, so we knew each other well. She was young, pleasant, very quiet, and I thought she was helpful." Further background checks by the police showed Alet to have demonstrated some more sinister patterns of behaviour. A family friend described her as growing up in a good, hard-working family in the nearby village of Corby Glen, where her home life was remarkably stable. But as an adolescent, Alet was found on several occasions to dress herself up in bandages and casts to cover up non-existent injuries, without actually allowing the injuries to be examined or even treated, in apparent attempts to gain sympathy and attention. Later on in her life, while training as a student nurse, peculiar incidents seemed to follow her around, including fires in the toilets, strange noises in the night, curtains set on fire in the nurse's accommodation room, and on one occasion, human feces were found to be smeared across the walls and carefully stored in employee fridges. Confirmed reports also describe bizarre episodes of her hiding knives under patients' pillows and knocking walking sticks out of elderly residents' hands. When confronted about these occurrences, she would deny all responsibility. On one occasion, she even claimed them to be the work of a poltergeist. Outside of her nursing training, Alet also spent a considerable time as a patient in hospital, seeking medical attention for a string of physical ailments. This culminated in an exceptional absentee level with over 100 days of absence during a single year of her nursing training. During one of her admissions as a patient to a hospital, her persistent complaints led to the surgical removal of a healthy appendix. When the post-surgical wounds were seen to heal poorly, nursing staff reported that Alet had repeatedly interfered with the sutures and dressings that should have been helping her wounds to heal normally. Having trained as a nurse in adult medicine, she was refused a position on the basis of her poor attendance and successive nursing examination failures. But Alet was undeterred and subsequently applied to the pediatrics ward, convincing those in charge that she always wanted to work with children and would endeavour to learn the relevant skills required of the role. Management at Grantham Hospital had been dealing with long-standing issues with staff shortages on Ward 4, and they were persuaded by Alet's apparent passion for the role. They awarded Alet with a temporary 6-month contract. When she started at Grantham Hospital, there were only 2 trained nurses present on the day shift and just 1 for the night shifts, which may have explained the lack of supervision of Alet's working. While all of this information was useful to Detective Clifton's broader understanding, he still lacked firm evidence tying Alet to the crimes. But further blood testing was about to change that. Blood samples of 13 patients underwent specialist toxicology testing. Multiple samples once again tested positive for raised insulin or potassium, and all 13 of the children had been under Alet's care. The police now had proof that poisonous chemicals were in the patient's blood at the time of their collapse, specifically when under Beverly Alet's care. With this new information, Detective Clifton brought Alet back for further questioning. Gone was the defiant and combative Beverly Alet. Now she refused to answer any questions at all. She declared at the time, "I've already been interviewed at great length by police in relation to the various allegations made. I've been under great pressure because of the vast amounts of media attention on me, and in this case do not therefore wish to answer any more questions." Alet had no response to all of the compelling evidence of her guilt presented by the detectives. They were making no progress, so instead they looked for any sign of remorse. They asked her, "Do you feel anything for the parents of these children? It's quite sad really, isn't it? In particular Claire Peck, a 15-month-old girl who smiles and winks at the staff." Alet responded coldly to each of their comments. No reply. In October 1991, Alet was charged with 4 counts of murder, 13 of attempted murder, and 13 of grievous bodily harm. As she awaited her trial, she rapidly lost weight, developing anorexia nervosa. This and other complaints caused numerous delays, but on the 15th of February 1993, nearly 16 months later, Alet was taken to trial at Nottingham Crown Court, where she pleaded not guilty. Detective Michelle Billingsley took Alet to her first court appearance, and she said of that time, "that I was shocked that someone could do all these things and not feel any remorse whatsoever. But not only was there no remorse, it was her smile, the shrugging of her shoulders. She was leaning forward, looking out the van at the people that had gathered round the court, as if she were looking forward to appearing there." Prosecutors demonstrated to the jury how she had been present at each suspicious episode. They showed evidence of the readings of high insulin and potassium in each of the victims, as well as the drug injection and puncture marks. All could be linked to Alet. In addition, she was accused of cutting off her victims' oxygen supply, either by smothering them directly or by tampering with the machines. Alet's defense team employed Professor Roy Meadows to give expert testimony at the trial. He explained Munchausen syndrome and Munchausen syndrome by proxy to the jury. The first is a mental health illness characterized by simulated illness combined with pathological lying. The second is the simulation of illness, not in themselves, but in a person that they care for. Numerous theories have been suggested for the reasons behind both illnesses. They may be due to very low self-image and a strategy to strengthen their own identity. Through attention and sympathy, they may attempt to gain control. Professor Meadows went on to explain how throughout Alet's life, she demonstrated symptoms of both, right up to her court appearance, where her apparent illnesses manipulated those around her and delayed the start of her trial. Her behavior had initially been typical for Munchausen syndrome, but when her behavior failed to elicit the desired reaction in others, she began to harm others to satisfy her desire to control and to be noticed. More recent developments in the understanding of Munchausen syndrome by proxy highlight that it is the psychological reward for behavior that serves as the primary motivator for those affected. In Alet's case, her escalation to colleagues of her patients' deteriorations served as the motivation in the attention and reward that she subsequently gained. Speaking on behalf of the defense, Professor Meadows concluded with his opinion that Beverly Alet would never be cured of her mental health condition, and that she would remain a danger to anyone she might contact. Due to repeated illness, Alet attended for only 16 days of her 2-month trial, but she was convicted on the 23rd of May 1993 and given 13 life sentences for murder and attempted murder. It was the most severe sentence ever delivered to a female, but according to Mr. Justice Latham, it was commensurate with the horrific suffering of her victims, their families, and the ignominy she had brought upon nursing as a profession. Alet was taken to Holloway Prison, but she would not stay there for long. Once in prison, she refused to eat or to drink, and she was explicitly engaging in self-harming behaviors. As well as being diagnosed with a psychopathic disorder, she was also deemed to be putting her life and the lives of other inmates at risk. The trial judge said, "Once it is accepted that the offender was suffering from a mental disorder, difficult ethical and indeed philosophical questions arise as to the degree to which responsibility for the offences in question should be regarded as diminished. I have found that there is an element of sadism in Miss Alet's conduct and her offending, but that sadism is itself, if not the result, certainly a manifestation of her mental disorder, and it would be unduly simplistic to treat it in the same way as one would if the offender were mentally well." Having considered all of the medical evidence, the presiding judge was satisfied that Alet was suffering from an abnormality of the mind when she committed her offences. She was transferred to Rampton Secure Hospital, a high-security facility predominantly housing individuals detained under the Mental Health Act. She had only spent a week at Holloway Prison. A pre-trial psychiatric assessment found that Alet had been mentally fit to plead, which raises serious questions about the authenticity of the original symptoms that moved her to Rampton. Was this merely more evidence of Alet's manipulative behavior? While this high-security facility imposes significant limitations on Alet's freedoms, it is not the same as a life behind the bars of a prison. Rampton Secure Hospital has 1,400 staff who manage the 400 inmates. The cost to UK taxpayers approximates to £2,400 a week for each of the inmates. A degree of male-female interaction is also permitted, and in 2001, it was reported that Alet was engaged to a fellow inmate called Mark Heggie, who himself had been admitted after attacking a lady in North London and then drinking his victim's blood. A spokesperson for Rampton Hospital said of relationships between inmates that they are monitored by doctors and other staff, and if the patients are found to be of sound mind and they want to marry, then they can do so. The spokesperson continued, "Relationships do develop. In fact, they are good for the patients because it is part of their normalization." Bradley Gibson was just 5 years old when he survived an attack by Alet. 27 years later, he said of Alet, "She's a criminal. She's a murderer. She's a child murderer. and she's living the life of Riley in Rampton Secure Hospital. She should be serving her life sentences in a prison behind bars. Professor Todd Hoag was the lead psychologist for Rampton Secure Hospital between 1995 and 2008. When it was suggested to him that Alet may have manipulated her admission to avoid imprisonment, Professor Hoag responded, "It's very difficult to simply manipulate your way into prison or into a hospital, otherwise they'd be full of all sorts of people that shouldn't be there. It's not impossible that somebody changes their presentation to try and do what they think is best for them, but that's not an easy task, and you're going to have to do that consistently with a whole bunch of people who are trained to see whether or not you're accurately saying what you're saying and doing what you said you did." The debate on the manner of Alet's conviction has raged on ever since. Detective Superintendent Stuart Clifton had led the investigation at Grantham Hospital, and he was pivotal in ensuring that Alet was brought to justice. At the time, he was faced with an uphill task. In particular, there was a weight of expert medical opinion that suggested that the collapses on Ward 4 were due to natural causes. But he also received considerable pressure internally from senior police figures, who were concerned by the lack of forensic evidence, and even urged him to abandon his investigation at Grantham Hospital. Many times he has been asked why he felt compelled to pursue his suspicions. He later said, "Over time, detectives develop a sixth sense, and particularly experienced detectives. And there was something in this case that just rankled with me, that just didn't seem quite true." Some months following her conviction, Detective Clifton went to visit Alet. Following his meeting with her, he said, "She wouldn't give any explanation as to why she did it, and she showed no evidence of remorse. She merely said, 'I didn't do 13, I only did 9. Not long after Clifton's meeting with Alet, she made an application to become a lifetime patient and therefore avoid the prospect of ever being transferred back to prison. It is in this application that she clearly admits to all 13 crimes of which she was originally convicted. The implications of Alet's supposed diagnosis by Professor Meadows have meant that she has been held ever since in a secure hospital rather than in a general prison. As suggested by the presiding judge overseeing Alet's conviction, it is difficult to know how much of Alet's responsibility is diminished by her illness. And there has been considerable academic debate on the subject. The concept of social learning theory provides an alternative explanation for some of Alet's actions. As earlier mentioned, she was frequently seen to be wearing plasters, bandages, or even casts as a way of falsifying injuries or illness. She did this because she perceived the consequences of injury and illness to be positive due to the attention she received instead of being negative, which is the usual interpretation of how most people feel about being harmed. When her attention-seeking behaviors went so far as to convince doctors to remove her appendix unnecessarily, she would have experienced severe pain. But this was outweighed by the greater degree of attention that she received. Explaining the transition from self-harm to the desire to harm others becomes more difficult to explain. Working in healthcare, it is likely that she would have witnessed the attention that staff or family members receive when someone in their care has been seriously ill or even died. At first, Alet's actions did not result in death, but instead made children unwell, and she subsequently made them better. This process provided her with the attention she desired, and through positive reinforcement, her actions quickly escalated in severity, up to the point where her patient started dying. But for Alet, It seemed that even death would not serve as a negative reinforcement, because the attention she received only made this process desirable. An example of this is when the nurse in charge on Ward 4 actually praised Alet publicly by saying, "Poor Beverly Alet has been there on every occasion. She has been a rock." Forensic psychiatrist Professor Jeremy Coyd provided another possible explanation for her actions. He observed that for Alet, there may well have been an element of fireman syndrome. Fireman syndrome is the phenomenon that occurs when the perpetrator intentionally creates an undesirable predicament, often at great cost to others, in order to seek personal recognition when they subsequently resolve the problem that they created. An example of this is in the case of Katie Phillips, where the victim's mother held Alet in such high esteem that she actually asked her to be her surviving child's godmother. Little did she know of the terrible harm Alet had inflicted on her family. Professor Coyd went on to say of Alet, "There might have been a much, much darker thing, where she sits with the child in her arms, watching it die, and getting off on the control of that. Because the act of killing can be enormously exciting. It can be enormously pleasurable. It would have had a very important purpose to her. The question is, has she told anybody why she did it?" In 1999, 8 years after Alet's terrible attacks, Grantham Hospital agreed to compensate the 13 sets of parents of the affected children. This included £2 million worth of damage to the Phillips parents, who not only had Becky taken from them, but also whose surviving twin daughter, Katie, would live on with severe disability for the rest of her life. The impact Alet's case had on Grantham Hospital was so severe that the maternity unit was closed down altogether. The appalling nature of her crimes has placed her on the Home Office list of criminals who will never be eligible for parole. It is thanks to the doctors on Ward 4 that not more children came to harm. In particular, it is due to the outstanding determination and detective intuition of Superintendent Detective Stuart Clifton that Alet was brought to justice for her heartless crimes. The telling of this story is in dedication to the memory of the innocent children who did not survive Alet's merciless killings. Liam Taylor, Timothy Hardwick, Becky Phillips, and Claire Peck. Thank you for listening to this first episode of Series 2 of Nightmares of a Doctor. Information regarding the sources used for this episode are available in the show notes. If you have any further thoughts or feedback for the show, please feel free to get in touch via our Instagram account, Nightmares of a Doctor, or via email, nightmaresofadoctor@gmail.com.